Lecture 19, Fear and the Construction of Satan.
Welcome to Lecture 19. In Lecture 18, I completed sort of presenting a very broad panorama of the social and economic and political reasons, and we ended up with the spectacle of the witches being burned or hung from the necks as a kind of theater of power. In this lecture, I want to continue to essentially examine some of the causes for the witch craze, but also attempt to explain why this happened. And I'm going to essentially look at two very specific things. One, the question of fear in the West and how that fear is used by those in power to create scapegoats. And two, the role of Satan or the devil in witchcraft and, of course, in the witch craze, and how the devil has changed from the Middle Ages into the early modern period, the new concept of the devil. And we will sort of trace the history of the devil in the Western tradition up to the early modern period. I want to begin essentially by asking you to think about the kinds of beliefs that the majority of the people had in the early modern period, in the late 15th and early 16th century, the kinds of expectations they have. First of all, think about this. They believe, culture people as well as those who were illiterate, they believe that there was this vast conspiracy which was presided by the devil, which joined together people from every part of Europe, but mostly from Northern Europe and mostly from Germany, and that these people were in a kind of conspiracy against Christianity and against order. That these women, for they were mostly women, these old women, for they were mostly old women, wrote to great nocturnal gatherings in the back of devils, that they engage in sex with the devils, that they in fact perform all kinds of atrocities, which I will discuss later on in greater detail. Child murder, sacrifices, orgies, all kinds of other things that they did at these nocturnal gatherings. In Lorraine alone, a region between Germany and France, there were believed to be 800 meeting places for these nocturnal gatherings. It is said, and people believe this to be so, that at the great witch gathering at Hendaya, a town on the border between France and Spain, in the Basque region, 12,000 witches flew or were transported in the back of devils to this gathering. Think about this. It is as if now we will have a great convention of historians, the American Historical Association meeting or the MLA meeting, and all the participants come riding in the back of devils to attend these meetings. This was, of course, even further affirmed by the eerie, should we say it, quality of confessions extracted on the torture that we began to discuss in the previous lecture, or confessions which were given voluntarily without torture, for in England torture was not allowed. All these confessions have an eerie similarity. They all say the same. These women, mostly women, but sometimes men as well, confess to the same kinds of activities of attending these nocturnal gatherings, which I will describe in detail later on, of performing certain evils, I am paying homage to Satan, and so on. What we are talking about here is a kind of conditions which lead to some extraordinary sense of fear in society. Now, there is some explanations for this. The culture of the Middle Ages was a culture of the cities. It was a culture of the plains. Parts of Europe in the late 15th and early 16th century had not yet been fully Christianized. The Christianity of some mountain regions in areas of Europe, the Pyrenees, the Harz Mountains, the Alps, and so on, were practices, that is to say, was a kind of religion, was a kind of Christianity that was still intertwined with all kinds of superstition and so on. It is only in the late 15th century that mendicant orders, that is to say Franciscans and Dominicans, come to these mountain areas in the process of proselytizing, or indeed bringing Christianity to these regions, when you join this with the fact that you enter areas which have not been fully Christianized, filled with all kinds of folkloric details about nocturnal gatherings, with about folklore about animals or men turning to animals or werewolves or all those kinds of things which are part and parcel of European culture and which I will discuss in the last lecture of this series of lectures. All those things, and you tie that to the new enforcement of orthodoxy by both Protestants and Catholics after the 1550s, you have here the makings of a pathology. And how does this work? It works in very specific ways. It works in the following manner. You select a group. You essentially direct your anger, or you categorize, or you stereotype not an individual. It's not the individual Jew, or it's not the individual wish that you are after. It's as a group of people. And then the second step is you create a mythology out of the need for a scapegoat. Because of all the changes that have taken place before, what we have here is the creation of a mythology about witches. In 1350, 1348, during the period of the Black Plague, the Black Death, the Great Plague that essentially swept throughout Europe, there were specific scapegoats. There were those suffering from leprosy. There were the Jews. They were not attacked as individuals. They were always attacked as a group. By the late 15th century, in some areas, it is a converso in the Iberian Peninsula who becomes, as it were, the scapegoat. In Northern Europe, it's the witch. So in a sense, what you have here is a construction of a mythology. Now, this is very important because this mythology, some historians have argued, it was something constructed from above. That is to say, there is a dual process. There is fear at the bottom, created by all the anxieties that I have been describing before, and there is a construction of a mythology from above. That is to say, it's the way in which you link together the anxieties and fears of the people at the bottom, and you bring it together and you link it with a construction of a mythology from above. As I have said to you before, it was almost a universal attitude of Europeans, of Western Europeans, the belief that witches existed, that they were essentially in league with Satan, with the devil, to destroy Christian society. Some of the greatest names, Newton, Bodin, great scientists, they all affirm the validity and the veracity of these activities. But it is also fed from below. So what you have here is a way in which a learned discourse on witchcraft, which we are going to explore in the next lecture, a learned discourse of witchcraft, treatises and so on, links together with this widespread fear. As I was saying to you, some historians, most notably a French historian named Jean de Lumont, has argued in a great book entitled Fear in the West that this fear is part of a process by which the state, the nascent state, all those institutions that are attempting essentially to create order and to monitor the activities of Western society, channel all the frustrations and the fears of the general population, what we might call a kind of mass psychosis, a mass pathology, and in a sense directed against one particular target. In this case, of course, all women, people accused of witchcraft. How does this work? Now, please understand that this is something that works to this very day. It is a process and it's a mechanism that is employed by governments and those in power to this very day, and which serves specifically the purpose, it benefits the state in taking the mind of people from other more serious problems. Now, think about this. The people are essentially pressed down. The people are oppressed by rising taxation, by conscription, by new ways in which their lives are monitored. The people resist. Resistance in the 16th century, in the early modern period, takes the form of vagrancy, scam artists, deserters, banditry. Wherever you go in Europe in the 16th century, you are in the face, you are facing a general crisis of society, which is demonstrated in these attacks against the state. in many respects, the people on the margins of society, bandits, vagrants, picaros in Spain, scum artists, the kind of people who lived against the state and who tried to undermine the power of the state. Now, this is paradoxical because, of course, these people are represent a form of resisting the encroaching power of the state, but at the same time, they, of course, add to the anxieties of the people at the bottom because, as we well know, the greatest victims of crimes, the people who suffer the most from these kinds of resistance and activity, are essentially the people at the bottom. So essentially, while at the same at one time, these people who are engaged in these activities are in some, should we say, diffuse way, not perhaps very conscious, but unconsciously resisting the new controls that have been imposed on society, at the same time, they are creating the conditions that are going to lead to a greater control. So people, instead of thinking about all the problems they have to face, taxes, traffic in the highways, pollution, all the kinds of things, it's so much easier to blame all this, not on the people who are responsible for these things, but on someone who is a very vulnerable target and an scapegoat. That is to say that the attack against witches, very much as the attack against Jews, or very much like the attack against people suffering from leprosy, was something that had an extraordinary amount of popular support. There is this incredible swell from below, and this attack against specific groups of people who are identified as scapegoats is essentially fanned by the mendicants, by the Dominicans and Franciscans in Catholic countries, or by preachers, Protestant preachers in the north, who in a sense work or act as tribunes of the people, as people who in fact articulate this unbelievable fear in society. This is a wonderful formulation, and I think one that is quite accurate. And it's very difficult to pin it down because we don't have the sources to say, well, this is absolutely consciously planned. That is to say, there is a meeting of the ministers in Paris or in Madrid or in London, and they said, okay, how do we make people not think about... Let's not think about the fact that we're going to conscript 200 of them in this village. Well, hey, witches. No, I don't think that we can pin this down like this. But it works in a kind of unconscious manner in which the state throws out all of its weight, together with that of the church, against an attack against certain segments of the population. And therefore create, as I was saying in the previous lecture, this kind of theater of power, which serves as a form of entertainment, but which also has very important pedagogical purposes, because it teaches people that here is the person who is responsible for all your difficulties, for all the problems we face. And if we exorcise this person from our society, if we, in a sense, punish this person, then everything will be all right. That we are, as a collective, engaged in a great battle against the forces of evil. That they are the agents of the enemy. Of course, the United States went through something like this in the 1950s. It's called McCarthyism. That is to say, under every bed there was a communist hiding there to do some kind of evil things. So you essentially take the people's mind from all problems and direct it against this unseen, undefined menace that is all around you, and it leads you to a tremendous interest in essentially cooperating and being part and being complicit in the manner in which certain segments of the population is put to death and executed. Now, clearly there is a difference between the 16th century and the 20th century. And the difference, of course, is that while today we all have our own individual neuroses, in the 16th century, there is a collective pathology. And that collective pathology was, of course, was dominated by the figure of the devil. And it is the devil in the Western tradition and the devil that emerges in the 16th century that makes all the difference. Because it is not that you are cooperating with a foreign government or with some kind of ideology that is essentially repulsive to your way of thinking, so to democracy. Here you are cooperating against the great enemy, the great obstructor. That's what the word means in Hebrew. Satan, the obstructor, the one who in a sense stands against society, against Christianity, against godliness, against the good. Now, who is this devil? And how does he come into being? Where is he coming from? And how does he change over time? Well, there is a very important theological problem here. And it's a theological problem that some of the great theologians of Christianity has essentially dealt with and struggled with. And that is, of course, where does evil come from? What is the nature of evil? If God is all-powerful and all-good, if she is all-powerful and good, how come is there evil on the world? This is one of the questions that tormented Augustine of Hippo continuously. How do I define evil? Where does evil come from? We turn and we look around us and we see evil everywhere. So where does this come from? With the sources in the Western tradition of the idea of evil, which are peculiar to our culture, are to be found in Persia, in very ancient Persia, in the world that produced not only Zoroastrian religion and divided the world between two opposed forces, evil and good, but also that produced Manichaeism, a dualistic way of seeing the world. So, though it is very clear that in the Christian religion or in the Judeo-Christian Muslim religions, God is superior to the devil. And the devil, in some essentially tormented way, acts only because God gives permission to the devil to act. That is to say, the devil is acting because God essentially permits the devil to do all these things and to corrupt all these people, which sounds to me unbelievably sadistic. Because, after all, why should we have to carry the burden of this test? Nonetheless, what we have here is a very difficult situation because, on the one hand, Christians in the 16th century attribute a great deal of power to the devil, but on the other hand, they are also aware and they have to maintain theologically to be sound in their views that the devil operates only with the consent of God. Now, this devil, of course, is represented to us in many different ways. I want to, in a sense, read two passages from the Bible, which are essentially very descriptive of what the devil and how the devil is seen. This is from Isaiah 14, 12, 15. How have you fallen from the heavens, O morning star, son of the dawn? How are you cut down to the ground? You who mowed down the nations, you said in your heart, I will scale the heavens above the stars of God. I will set my throne. I will take my seat on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet then shalt you be brought down to hell into the sides of the pit. Think about this. This is Isaiah. This is an image of the devil falling down, the son of the dawn, a brighter star, Lucifer. This is the same devil as we find in Milton, which is an incredibly attractive devil falling down from the skies into the pits of hell. A beautiful, bright angel whose sin has been to try to, in fact, challenge God in his power. And then, of course, there is the other one from Revelations, from the book St. John's Apocalypse. And there was a battle in heaven. Michael and his angels battled with the dragon. And the dragon fought and his angels. And they did not prevail. Neither was the place found any more in heaven. And that great dragon was cast down, the ancient serpent, he who is called the devil and Satan, who leads astray the whole world. And he was cast down to the earth, and with him his angels were cast down. So in a sense we have here the devil as a dragon, as a serpent, the kind of the first deceiver, the first tempter, the one who comes into paradise to corrupt humanity. So in a sense, we have these different views of the devil and the way in which Christianity, borrowing from Judaism, accepts this idea of the devil. See, the problem in the 16th century is that it's not difficult to believe in the devil. If you are a Christian, then you must believe in the devil. You must believe in the power of the devil. baptism is in fact a form of exorcism of the devil. Just what you do when you are baptized, you exorcise the devil. And one of the things that your godfather does and your godmother does too is essentially to reject Satan, to reject the devil and embrace God. The devil appears to us in the Gospels. It is the devil who comes essentially and tries to entice Jesus by promising him all kinds of things if he will adore him. This is a word, essentially a kind of phrases that we will find again and again and again in a later period. That is to say, the devil is the god of the witches. We know, for example, that Mary Osgood in Salem in 1692 declared, not on the torture, but on the questioning by his judges and accusers, that, and I quote, that the devil told her he was her god and that she should serve and worship him. So in a sense, what you have here is an image of the devil as wanting to be like God. But then on the other hand, there are biblical passages. We find the devil sitting by the side of God. And in the book of Job, which is one of the cruelest books in the Bible, think about this. There is God sitting with the devil. Look around the earth. Look, oh my, do you know how good my servant Job is? You know, he's really great. He's a terrific man. And the devil says, well, yeah, he's fine. He has everything going. He has BCRs and BMWs and his wife is wonderful and his children are great. Why she should not be a good believer in you? Why he should not love you? Okay, well, have a go at him. Punish him and see if he still loves me or not. And so the devil is given permission by God to go down there and absolutely torture this guy. Boils a terrible nagging wife, kill his children, loses his job, loses his BCRs, his DVD, his BMWs, but he remains faithful. And then, of course, because he has remained faithful, he is rewarded with a new wife and new children. There's something wrong with this story here. There's something very wrong with this story. But it shows you again that the very ambivalent way in which the devil appears and it is used and portrayed, doing God's bidding, working against God, opposing God, essentially his servant as well. Which of course lead us to the, again, to rephrase this question, where does evil come from? What is the source of evil? Augustine's answer was that evil is there to show us the good, as a kind of way, okay, so this is evil, and so we can appreciate the good, that we cannot live in the good all the time, otherwise we will not know the value of the good. That is not a very convincing answer at all. What we know, however, is that the devil appears continuously. The very early monks, the very early anchorites, the people who went into the desert, were continuously assaulted by the devil. And of course, that devil that tormented the very early monks and the very early anchorites, the people who went into the desert to escape the corruption of the world, that devil always have a kind of, shall we say, sexual connotations. Many of the temptations of the devils were always in the form of sexual enticement. This is the case of Simon in the desert. This is a case, a famous case of St. Anthony, who lived in a cave night after night and who is tormented by the devil, who comes to him and show him very lewd pictures, very awful kind of exciting sexual enticement until he falls by his extraordinary fear. And I already told this story here in an earlier lecture. By tormented by his desire for this, by his attraction to these unbelievable lurid images that the devil presents to him, hangs a piece of meat from the cave, from the roof of the cave, and embraces corrupted meat. So he is reminded of the corruptiveness of the flesh, of the fact that the spirit lives on and the flesh dies. So in a sense, what we have here is a very different images of the devil. The devil is, of course, always present in the monastery. A good number of the stories and accounts of monks and monasteries tells us always of the danger of the devil that is again by the side. And then, of course, we have Dante's Alighieri in the end of the Inferno, the last canto of Inferno, which is one of the most dramatic endings. There is the devil in the middle of a pond of ice, not fire, but eyes. And he describes it as follows. How chill and faint I turn it then, do not ask, reader, for I do not write it, since all words will fail. I did not die, and I did not remain alive. Think not for thyself, if thou hast any wit, what I became, deny both death and life. The emperor of the woeful kingdom, that is Satan, the emperor of hell, stood forth amid breaths from the eyes, and I compare better with a giant than giants with his arms. See now what that hole must be to answer to such a part. If he was as fair as he is now foul, and lifted up his brows against his maker, well may all sorrow come from him. And how great a marvel it seemed to me when I saw three faces on his head, one in front, and that was red, the other two joined to it just over the middle of his shoulder, and all joined at the crown. The right seemed between white and yellow, the left had such an aspect as the people from where the Nile descends. On their each came forth two great wings of size fitting for such a bird. Sails at sea I never saw like this. They had no feathers, but were like a bat's, and he was beating them so that the three winds went forth from him, by which the cocytus was kept frozen. Here is a very different image of the devil, a kind of image that will become engraved in the medieval mind. The devil as a kind of monster, as an extraordinary monster with wings like a bat, in body, in eyes. Strangely enough, there is a recent commercial which shows hell as a place which is exceedingly cold, which is essentially a takeoff from Dante, and is a way in which popular culture incorporates sort of culture themes or erudite or important themes. Now, what happens as we move into the late 15th century and the early 16th century is, of course, that the devil acquires a very different personality. And that personality of the devil in the late 15th and early 16th century is, of course, that of the Jew. The stereotype of the devil, the way in which the devil is represented in the iconography of the period, is the stereotypical representation of the Jew. And in that sense, the kind of representations of the devil taps into the latent antisemitism, not latent sometimes, but very vivid antisemitism of the Middle Ages. And it, in fact, brings one with the other. And so, in a sense, we move to a very different world. And when we look at the confessions of witches who are tortured or who confess automatically to these matters, you could see how the devil is described by them. Sometimes in these nocturnal gatherings, he's represented as a he-goat. And if you look at some of the etchings by Goya of the early 19th century, the very dark etching of the dark paintings that he painted, you could see the presence of the he-goat associated not only with extreme sensuality, but also with a kind of animal figure. Or he is described, not yet, that we have to wait for the kind of existential devil for Goethe's Faust or for essentially Milton's beautiful image, a kind of horrible figure, a sort of monster-like figure who in his feature, in his nose and so on, imitate the vision of the Jew. In 1645, Widow Bash, a Suffolk witch in England, declares herself as having sexual intercourse with the devil, declares that he was colder than man. Many people argue that he was neuter, that is to say, some kind of aberration, not really human, not fully anything, a kind of monster which led the armies of witches against Christianity in early modern Europe. Thank you.